I'm an alcoholic. My name is Brandon. And it is a pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker. I want to read a paragraph because I think it kind of speaks to who he is and how he approaches this thing. It says, "Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and more wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances." Both you and the new man must walk day by day. And so to me, it's real easy to look good in meetings, and it's real easy to sound good in meetings and share those things. But when you actually get to spend some time with a person outside of these meetings, and you get to walk day by day with that person, and you get to experience their life and the things that they encounter, both good and bad, and you see how they handle it, you see how they progress down the path, it reinforces the fact that this really works. And the guy I'm introducing tonight is not only my sponsor, but he's probably one of the best friends I've ever had in my entire life, because he really does this thing, and he's really there, and he's really connected, and he really has a powerful, powerful message. And if you don't want to hear about God, well, then just don't hang out anymore, because that's what you're going to hear about tonight. So with that, give you Tarek.
Hey, everybody. My name is Tarek. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Tarek.
I'm never giving a talk with wet socks. My home group is the Roswell Men's Step Study. It's my Alcoholics Anonymous home group. I also am a member of another fellowship. I want to get this out of the way. I'm a big singleness of purpose guy at Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, so I'm going to limit my experience tonight mostly to my struggles with alcoholism and the path that I followed to place myself in a position to be safe and protected. And I do have a job at my Cocaine Anonymous home group. I'm the treasurer. I think having a job is very important. That's the unity piece of what we find here. The first level of healing that takes place for us is when we walk in that door and we experience the sharing and the healing that happens because somebody tells your story. And you finally say to yourself, that didn't just happen to me. And so the healing begins. And so our bodies are taken into the fellowship, the unity that we find there. And for me, it's expanded. And we were talking about this at dinner, but the longer I'm here, the more important it is to have a group of men around me that I articulate what it's like to have shadows walking with me. I have to embrace the shadows in order to pull them into the light. I can't hide from the shadows. And that only happens when a group of men know what I'm struggling with. That's just the reality of it. And so Fit Spiritual Condition today is about that. It's also about the relationships in my life. It's no longer about how many times I pray and meditate. It's not about how many meetings I go to. It's not about how many men I sponsor. It's about the relationships in my life. Everything's about relationship in this existence for me. I carry my mind into the recovery process on a regular basis. Once a year, I go back through the first 9 steps. Now, I don't start writing inventory. For me, I believe people that I've seen go back to the 4th step, and that's where they start. It's about feeling better and managing your life. If you go back to the first 3 steps, you will begin to question powerlessness again. You'll look at current unmanageability. You'll start to ask yourself, what areas of your life are you agnostic, which means there is no God. I run the show. I don't trust God to provide for me. Therefore, I am agnostic. And I have to look at that. And then I reaffirm my 3rd step decision. So I look at the actions in my life, and they actually affirming my decision to walk this path. And then I write inventory. And that's how you take your mind into the recovery process. And service, for me, I separate. I help set up meetings. I help clean up. I love talking to people when they get to the meeting. That's all service for our fellowship, which I believe is part of unity. Service for the Spirit is when I sit down one-on-one. That's where the magic happens. I grow more spiritually when I watch someone grow spiritually, and I get caught up in that energy, and my state of consciousness elevates when I watch someone else's consciousness elevate. And that, to me, is the magic formula. So if you're new tonight and you're wondering, how does this thing work? First, they wrote a chapter called How It Works. Second, there's a magic formula. And the magic formula is recovery, unity, and service. That's it. It's not complicated stuff. It's really very simple. A power greater than myself separated me. And I want to emphasize the word separated, because I wasn't looking to get sober on the morning of November 5th, 2007. And I am eternally grateful for that separation. And it's interesting. I heard my buddy Carl give a talk the other night that was very profound for me, because he said that if we can somehow bottle what happens to us somewhere between that second and fifth drink, that's ecstasy. So what has to happen in Alcoholics Anonymous is the power you have to find here has to replace that and then some for this to work. That's what we're up against here. And that is a powerful ecstasy that used to happen to us somewhere between the second and fifth drink. See, the difference between me and a normal drinker is, like, the second or fifth drink bring you to the edge of a cliff, and the normal person realizes they're on the edge of a cliff, and they say, whoa, I'm going to tap the brakes, I'm going to slow down. Those of us that are real alcoholics and fit the description that's in the big book, we jump. We jump off the cliff. And when he said that the other night, it touched me, because I see why we lose so many people, because they don't get bit by the magic bug. For me, you can't compare the two. They're two completely different things. The magic that happens between the second and the fifth drink, and what happens here. But what happens here has a residual effect that the drink does not. Right? We lose power, choice, and control. We overshoot the mark over and over once we cross that invisible line. But when you're sponsoring people, and you witness the regenerative power of God, that has a residual effect. So people that have sponsored in here, you go meet that guy that's on fire, that story, Lindsay, at dinner about the girl with a year that just made your jaw hit the floor. She walks away and she feels the residual effects of that experience for weeks. A month? What was it? How long has it been?
Over a month.
Yeah, a month. A month. That's what's available to us here. You know, there's a few things I want to read out of this big book. As I share my experience tonight, I always follow a specific passage in the big book. And it says, in my personal story, I'm going to describe in my own language and from my own point of view how I established my relationship with God. That's the intent that I have tonight. And what I usually like to do is I'd like to read something out of the big book and see where it goes. And we're going to start with page 21. So what about the real alcoholic? He may start off, or she may start off, as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of his drinking career, he or she begins to lose all control of his liquor or her liquor consumptions once they start to drink. Page 24. The fact is that for most alcoholics, not all, for reasons yet obscure that we do not understand, we've lost the power of choice in drink. So you cannot admit you're powerless to something and then come in here and say you chose not to drink today. You can't have it both ways. You can't be powerless and then have a choice. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. I am unable, and here are the three key words, at certain times, which means I don't know what the day looks like when alcohol is going to come looking for me. I don't know what it's going to look like, how it's going to unfold, and what's going to cause me to pick up a drink. Which says I don't have the luck. I have to do this like I drink. Because I don't know. So at certain times, I can't bring into my mind or my consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of a week or a month ago. I'm without defense against the first drink. Page 30. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking or choose our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control, ever recovers choice. All of us felt at times that we're regaining choice or control, but at such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less choice and less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. We're like men and women who've lost our legs. We will not grow new ones. Page 34. For those who are unable to drink moderately, and I'm assuming if you're sitting in here on Friday night, you cannot drink moderately. The question is how to stop altogether, not one day at a time. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit, and this is the most important part, upon a so if you can quit on a non-spiritual basis, depends upon the extent to which you have already lost the power to choose whether you will drink or not. And I think the power of choice concept, pages 23 to 43 in the big book, are the most misunderstood pages in our book. If you're sponsoring, next time a sponsor relapses, come back and ask them, did you choose to relapse? And unfortunately, a lot of times you're going to say, yeah, I wanted to drink more than I wanted to stay sober. And you've misunderstood it, because the power of choice, loss of power of choice, means exactly that. That once I lose it, I don't get back. This concept of a choice, and this is the best way I've ever heard it, it's an intellectual sorting out process. Now, people sometimes think that in that moment I am choosing to pick up that drink. But we forget that the 4 or 5 hours previous to that, I'm sitting there telling myself, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. I'm not drinking today. I choose not to drink, and I drink anyway. And that's been my experience. And so in an intellectual sorting out process, I am presented with option A, option B, option C. I examine my options, and then I determine whether or not I want to accept them or reject them. That's where this concept of denial comes from, but denial is not used in our big book. And I don't think the authors just forgot to use the word. I think they purposely use words like delusion and illusion and obsession, and you can't tell the difference between what's true and false. And that's what those words mean. So Al-Anons, they suffer from denial. Right, they see the elephant in the room. They see the elephant in the room and they reject it. Alcoholics suffer from delusion. We don't even know the elephant's in the room. And so after I've worked the steps and I'm placed in fit spiritual condition, which is my responsibility, God keeps me safe and protected, and the illusion that I have a choice does not exist for me anymore. That's what happens here. So I did not wake up today and choose not to drink. My options this morning were like, I'm going to pray and meditate. I'm going to get up. Maybe I'll skip prayer meditation today. I'll take a shower. I'll do meditation later. I'll go downstairs. I will get up and go to Kroger and get some coffee for the house. Something like that. It wasn't, am I going to drink a handle of whiskey today? Am I going to start the day off with a nice Jim Beam on the rocks? No. That did not come across the screen this morning. Therefore, the illusion that I have a choice is gone. And that's what it means to be in fit spiritual condition. Because for years, alcohol was my anesthetic to deal with life. Alcohol would never have done so much to me if it had not done so much for me. I had a nervous disposition to life. I was ridiculously afraid of responsibility and being a productive member in society, but I was a really good chameleon. I could hide that from people. And I suffered, like most alcoholics do, from the burden of potential. Everybody around you says you have a lot of potential, and you tell yourself or ask yourself, where's this potential everybody says that I have? And that was the best description I can use to really try to identify with you on the internal condition. Because this problem that we have has three aspects to it. It's got the physical aspect to it. What happens to me once I start to drink? Most of the time, I can't control the amount. I don't know what's going to happen. And once I dig a little bit deeper, I look at, you know, they call the state of consciousness sobriety. Why is it that I go back to the drink? Well, it's not like 10 years into this, people have the mental obsession just show up. There's an internal condition that festers that shows up. I described it a second ago. The burden of potential, the anxiety, not having a sense of direction, afraid of being a failure, afraid of being abandoned because I went through that as a child. The justification of being molested and then having that be my excuse for doing things because I'm owed something that doesn't work for me anymore. So the process for me, the 12-step process, treats the internal condition. Therefore, there's no breeding ground for the mental obsession, and I don't put alcohol in my body, and I stay in a recovered state. The funny thing about alcohol, though, it not only changed me, it changed you. I could tolerate you because somehow in my mind, you changed. I heard a man describe it like that, and I said, man, that's exactly what happened. People were more tolerable. That was one of the effects that it produced for me. And the first time I truly felt alcohol work, we're at a pool party. And I can remember it. My buddy's parents let us drink. He had the parents that would take the car keys. And they had this swimming pool. And there was a shed in the swimming pool, about 10 feet of concrete. And all the guys at this party were getting up on this shed. And they were jumping into the pool. And they were impressing all the girls. And right, you know, I've got red hair. I got a bunch of freckles. I had a much bigger nose back then. I grew up in a Muslim household. I speak Arabic. I'm from Syria. I look like I'm Irish. I did not fit in. Right? I didn't fit in at all. And so I'm sitting there. And somehow, between the second and fifth beer, an effect was produced. And I had the courage to jump up, climb up on that shed and jump into that pool. And alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. It provided me with a personality change sufficient to overcome my insecurity. So I was an athlete, and I was a star athlete in high school, and I was a very smart kid, and I was academically inclined, so I was a periodic drinker. But I noticed that most of our weekend parties, there was only a handful of us that bowed to the porcelain god every weekend that we drank. I didn't drink all the time because my identity was in athletics. My identity was in academics. It had not become firmly grounded in alcoholism. I go to college. I get introduced to Widespread Panic and the Grateful Dead. So this is the summer before I go to college, and it would change the course of my life forever. And so this was summer 95. I get to college. I'm playing on this traveling basketball team. The college I went to didn't have athletics, but we had all-star intramurals, and we would play at different schools. We're going up to Dalton College, and there's a field party. And I remember sitting around in the dorm room, and I'll go to this field party, and I'll have a couple of drinks, and then I'll be back in the dorm room by 11, maybe midnight. That didn't happen. See, I took one, and then it took me. And I was in the stalls in the bathroom in my dorm dry heaving, 3-4 in the morning. So the dry heaves were so bad, I might have had a mild case of alcohol poisoning, but I couldn't play the next game, and I was a starter, and I had to take myself out. And so that's the loss of control. But here's the mental aspect and the internal condition. One of the guys on the basketball team had a fake ID, and we were all in the hotel room. There was four of us in each room, and we're sitting around, and he'd gone to the liquor store to get beer, and I told myself, I want to perform well tomorrow. I'm not going to drink tonight. I'm going to stay in the hotel room. But I couldn't sit still with myself. And therefore, you know what? I'll go have a couple beers in his room. I'll be back in my room by 10 or 11. That didn't happen either. Loss of control. The inability to stay away from the first one, no matter how great or the necessity or the wish to do so. Lack of power. That's my dilemma. Now I'll do the plug for my other substance. So I start living out of a hotel room. We leave Thursday. We go anywhere in the country. Widespread Panic is. We go see the shows Friday, Saturday, Sunday. We drive back to school. and the progression began, and all the other the drugs began. And then I met this one substance. It's white, and it did a lot for me. It rang my bell, so to speak. And I got out of college. I began selling drugs. I was introduced to this idea around 2004 when I went to my first 12-step meeting that perhaps I should not drink. Because when I drink, I do all these other things, and that's it. This is where I find my alcoholism, because the inability to control how much is so easy for me to see. I can go into the stories I just told you, and I go into happy hour when I was a benefit analyst for Century Business Systems. I managed to get a few good jobs, over the years, and I'd lose them, of course. But the proverbial happy hour of just somebody coming by your office saying, let's go get a couple drinks, just was never a couple of drinks for me. And the effect produced in me was so different from other people, We'd get to the bar around 5:30, I'd get a Budweiser, I'd get a shot, I'd get another Budweiser, I'd get another shot. They have one shot, they have one Budweiser. And 7 o'clock, it's time for them to go home. But I'm just getting started. I'm just getting to the edge of that cliff. And when I put the connection together that when I drink, I smoke crack, I didn't want to drink anymore. I did not want to drink anymore because I knew I couldn't control it. But see, the alcohol treated the internal condition. Alcohol allowed me to breathe. Alcohol loosened up my personal relationships. Alcohol removed my fear. Alcohol gave me a sense of happiness. Alcohol made all the 9-step promises come true for me, but I could not control the amount, and therefore I'd set off another spree. And so the years 2004 through 2007 were me going in and out, picking up white chips, lying, picking up chips I didn't get, and all that stuff, getting different sponsors, trying to work the steps, it just not working. And in 2006, I was fired from a job, a good job. And that landed me in my first treatment center. And I didn't do anything. I thought going to treatment for 90 days was the answer. And so I get out of treatment. I went to a halfway house. I was engaging in outside issues in that halfway house. I got back on the road with that band, Widespread Panic, and I began selling drugs. And then on the evening of November 4, 2007, I was arrested for drug trafficking. 2 Schedule 1 felonies in Jacksonville, Florida. And that's what I was like. Okay, now comes the what happened part of my story. I always love how people misquote that line in the big book. They always say, I'm going to tell you what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. So what is it? It can become from so many different viewpoints, emotions, personal relationships, money, consequences. Big book's pretty specific. In a general way, we disclose what we used to be like, the kind of person I was. And what happened is what I'm about to describe now, and then what I want to spend the rest of my time talking about is what it's like to grow in understanding and effectiveness. And so I get arrested. I began to have a spiritual experience. I began to work the first 3 steps without even knowing I was working the first 3 steps. So I stayed up all night in jail. In 2003, one of my dear friends, Jason, died the morning after my birthday. He was on his way to my house. He went to bed and didn't wake up. Overdosed. So November 5th, that morning, this knowing, and when I say knowing, I'm really saying God, this knowing came to me and said, today is your new sobriety day, and it is Jason's birthday. And I said, how cool is that? I can't make stuff like that happen. There's something moving around out here that's making this happen. And so I was in an inner city jail, and it was a very scary place. And every time I went to get my food tray, it was a pretty significant ordeal. And I began to go to Bible study, and they were passing around these spiritual books in the jail. 2 books, I remember, like Joel Osteen, Live Your Best Life Now, and this book called Exceeding Gratitude for Our Creator by a man named James Gills. And I read these books, and I listened to them read passages out of the Bible, and I was having total recall of something I'd heard at a 12-step meeting. And so the knowing at this point was exactly where I was going when I got out of jail. not only did I know I was going back to the rooms, I knew the meeting I was going to was in Sandy Springs. It was the one day at a time group. I knew the men I was going back to, and I knew the answer was in this book. Mine's green, but it's the blue book, the big book. I just knew it. There was no questioning it. And so when you don't question something, there's just that intuitive sixth sense that I had not even tried to develop, but was given to me as a gift. And I began to have that spiritual experience. So right there in that jail, I remember knowing that with everything in my body, I didn't want to go back to a life of alcohol and drugs. But everything in me knew I was going back to a life of alcohol and drugs. So I truly had finally reached the jumping off place. I truly had become hopeless. And that's where we want to get to. Hopelessness. Because from a place of hopelessness, you are catapulted into hope. And so here it comes. Here is where the liar inside of me was paralyzed for a portion of time. And what we call that in the rooms is the window of grace. But what really happens is the liar is paralyzed. Each one of us has a liar inside of us. He's there. She is there. And my liar was paralyzed when they took me into the courtroom, shackled to all these grown men. Nobody wanted to pick up my phone calls. My mom didn't want to have anything to do. She was devastated. Dad, devastated. Brother said, sit in jail. Best friend said, sit in jail. And my buddy Brian, for whatever reason, God used him to get me a lawyer. And he got me a lawyer. So we go to the arraignment. And I remember my lawyer approaches and I say, have you seen my mom? And he says, she's right behind you. And when I turned and looked at my mom, she was pale white. It looked like she hadn't eaten in weeks. And she about collapsed. And something in me broke. Something in me shifted. I was split wide open, as Peter M. says. And when I heard him use that description, I zeroed in on what happened to me in that courtroom. I was split wide open. The liar in me was dormant. I didn't have any ideas. I didn't have any game plan. I became willing to do whatever I had to. The paradox is, in order for me to become willing to do whatever I had to be reduced to nothing. Reduction to nothingness. That's what happened in that courtroom. And to fast forward, I finally get released, ROR, if I do 90 days inpatient. And granted, I have a minimum of 3 years in prison I'm looking at. My lawyer tells me, you're going to prison. We just don't know how long it's going to be. I'm going to try to get you into a boot camp, and maybe you'll serve a year. You'll do 18 months. They'll say 18 months, you get out in a year. But you have to mentally prepare yourself. And so the man, I get out. So this is the continuation. So now in jail, the surrender piece, okay, that is what you cannot work. You cannot work the surrender piece of the first step. That is given to you. You can go through this big book, ask yourself the questions, and see the powerlessness. You know, do I have this abnormal physical reaction? Do I have an inability to stay away from the first one? Do I have this internal condition? You can work all that. You cannot work a surrender. It's given to you. It's a true gift. And the surrender to me was the part of the first step that was worked in the jail. And then I became willing to believe that God was my answer. I was past really willingness. I'd been to enough meetings to know what I was going back for. I knew I was going back for this 12 steps and this God that I kept seeing in these books I was reading in the jail. And I made a decision to do whatever I had to. And that to me was my third step. And so they get me out. I get to a treatment center up and coming, and I was directed by the knower to go to the specific meeting. So when I got to the treatment center, I could not get them to say they would be willing to take me to the Friday night Sandy Springs meeting because nobody in the treatment center I was in really cared about recovery. They were all there just, you know, jacking off. And that's the way I look at it, you know. Here's a spiritual law for you. If your actions tell me you don't give a shit about your recovery, I don't give a shit. That's the reality of it. If your actions tell me you care, I will care. That's a spiritual law. So I get to the treatment center. I finally beat them down. This is where self-will run riot and living on self-propulsion comes in handy. And so I worked them down, and they took me to this meeting. And there's this guy, Randy, and Jerry and I know Randy very well. And I've been trying to get a hold of Randy because he's in with this guy named Dante. And they were like these mammoth figures to me. And so Randy's phone does not work. And I have to get to this Friday night meeting because this is where these guys are at. And we're late getting to the meeting. The meeting's already started. We get out of the druggy buggy. And there's one man on his cell phone out underneath that awning. And I walk up to him, and it's the man I've been trying to get a hold of. And I walked back into his life when he needed somebody to take through the steps. And I said, hey, I will do whatever you tell me to do. I don't want to live this way. I don't want to die. And we met every week. We covered a chapter in this book. It did not matter if we had to meet for 2 hours or 5 hours. We were getting through the chapter. So, you know, I already had over a month when I got out of jail. In 4 months, he took me through the process. So I'm 5 months in. I'm sponsoring people. I've never looked back. Right? The old timers used to try to squash my spiritual experience and tell me that the pink cloud's going to burst for you. You need to calm down. And it's been like this for me the entire time. Does that mean I haven't gone through some very dark periods in my recovery? Yes. But the trajectory's always been upward with dips and valleys, but it's been upward. And so the court case. Remember, I have these charges over my head. And so being the meticulous, organized person that I am, I began to document my entire recovery. And what I did was if I took a drug test, I had them give me a copy that I passed the drug test. I got my own apartment. I got a copy of the lease. The treatment center I was at thought I was an anomaly. They said, hey, will you do a big book study for us? I only had like 4 or 5 months. I started doing the big book study at the treatment center I was in. I then was offered a job as a clinical assistant, and I also had a job getting parking cars in Buckhead as a valet. I got back into grad school because I'd been kicked out of grad school. I got my own apartment. I mentioned that earlier, documented all of it. We had a motion to suppress evidence, and on August 9th, my lawyer, with this motion to suppress evidence, went to the DA's office in Duval County and said, look, this is what this young man's trying to do. This is our motion to suppress evidence, and the DA says, well, we're going to drop all the charges. This young man's trying to change his life. I was in my apartment, and all I could think about was one line in our big book. After reading these pages, we hope no further authentication will be necessary. I made a commitment to my creator that I was going to live the way of life described in this big book and do what this big book says until I leave this body. And that's what I've done. I'm very passionate about this process. I don't think you guys can tell that. I think this is what recovery is about. I don't know another approach that works with me, nor do I care to know one. This is it for me. This is it. The perspective of reworking the steps, there's two schools of thoughts in AA. You work the steps 1 through 9, you stay sober 10, 11, and 12. And it works for a lot of people. And the only morality, the true morality that's in Alcoholics Anonymous is if what you're doing works, you keep doing it. If what you're doing isn't working, then you want to maybe consider something else. I think that can be applied in any area of your life. And so I struggled around. I came out of the gates and made about 100 amends. I had about 230 amends towards people and institutions. I had in the ballpark of $30,000 in financial amends. And I made a ton of amends, and I paid back a lot of money, but not nearly $30,000. And around the 16-month mark, I began to suffer. I could not stand to be by myself. I always wanted to be doing something. And I began to experience what I think perhaps is one of the worst things for an alcoholic to experience. Boredom. Is this all there is? I was uneasy. I was easily annoyed by people in my life. And I had a feeling that I was just dissatisfied with what was going on. And I'll never forget this. There's a man up in Alpharetta named Nari. And this man stands outside of meetings and he hands out CDs. And he hands out two CDs in specific. And one's by the late Mark Houston and one's by a gentleman named Chris R. And I didn't listen to it when he gave it to me at 9 months. But I was driving home from the Alpharetta group one night, just not happy. Personal relationships sucked. I was spending money like I had a lot of money. I was sleeping around. I was treating women like they were objects. I was misguided. I think I'd probably fit the description of being miserable. And I threw the CD in, and the man on the CD said, "I love meetings that start with meditation." And I'd never heard anybody in the rooms talk about meditation. I think almost every Step 11 meeting I went to, if the topic started off about prayer and meditation, it surely ended up on prayer only. Or if they said meditation, it was when praying is when you talk and meditating is when you listen, which is not true in my book. And I set out to find somebody to knew this man on this CD. And I did. And he's sitting in the back row. And me, Mike and I were at Longhorn Steakhouse, and everyone was gone, and Mike and I are sitting there talking about this guy, Mark Houston, on this CD. As it turns out, Carl and Mike had met my sponsor, Scott. Scott's been my sponsor for the last 7 years, and Scott was sponsored by the man on the CD. And so Scott didn't have time to sponsor me, so he said, "You need to work the steps with Mike." And granted, at this time, I'm 32, and Mikey's 21 or 22. So you want to have an ego-deflating experience, you go ask someone 10 years younger than you to take you through the process. And I was so hungry for what I heard on that CD that I submitted to the process. And it was like I was catapulted into the fifth dimension of existence. And so meditation became very important to me. And I'll tell you a little story about, you know, I moved back in with my parents, and, you know, there had been this building off the street near my parents' house for years that I'd never really taken the time to see what this building was. And so one night I am walking my dog, and it's about a mile down from the entrance to my parents' neighborhood, and there's a big banner that says free meditation classes. And it was right at the time Scott and I started talking about this practice of meditation. And it was a Buddhist monastery. It still is. And I went and took all the classes for 2 years. On most weekends, you know, they'd go 3 months, and then you take a month off. And I'd go there. They taught me about Buddhism. They taught me about meditation. And today I'm here to say that meditation is by far the most effective and useful tool I have to walk the spiritual path. And I got back into my amends. And I'm going to tell you... I'm going to share with you that I guess now it's going on 6 weeks ago, maybe 5 weeks, I wrote my last 5 letters. I have now approached everyone on my original 8-step list. All that I have left to pay back is $20,000. And those amends are in the process of being made. That to me is just incredible. You know, I started this new endeavor of mine in my professional life. And maybe a year and a half ago, I went to my ex-girlfriend's family. Now, she'd recently had a failed suicide attempt, and she's a very bad, meth addict. And I went to her family to make amends. I went to her sister, her sister's husband, and her mother, and I made amends to them. And I got this LinkedIn message from her. She had gone and seen what I was trying to do professionally. And she said she loved me, and she said that I always knew you would become the man I hoped my sister would marry. That's not possible without making amends. We always think the amends are about us getting free. And I'm sorry, half of you in this room have already heard this story, but I'm going to tell it anyway. So we don't know the ripple effect of what happens when we make amends, but we also don't know the ripple effects of our selfish, self-centered actions. And so in 2003, I slept with my best friend's fiance. I devastated an entire group of friends. I forced people to pick sides. And as part of my 8-step, a bunch of people from that experience showed up. And I had to seek them out, and I had to make amends. And it started with my buddy Chris, and I slept with his fiance. And I took him out to lunch. We made the amends. And I asked 3 important questions when you make amends. Did I leave anything out? Do you need to tell me how this makes you feel? That's the most important. It's almost more important than asking them what you need to do to make it right. Because when you ask someone, do you need to tell me how this makes you feel, you have just now given them a green light to unload on you. And then you get to watch and live in color what your addictions, your alcoholism, your character defects, your selfishness, all that does, what it does to other people, what people go through when we're tornadoes running through their lives. And so tears for him, it's always been difficult for me to cry for some reason. I don't know why that is. But his tears were just like a faucet. And that was part of the ego deflation that happens in that when you see that. And the power of making amends really came to me in 2010 when I went out to the monastery for a big book conference. And the facilitators at the conference asked us to bring something that meant a lot to us. Well, that man whose wife or fiance I slept with gave me a pendant that was wrapped because he loved me so much. And we were all went up to the front and we all told the story that was attached to our that momentous object that we brought with us. That's the power of amends. As part of those same set of amends, we used to meet at this other couple's apartment to have sex while they were gone. And so I took them out to dinner to make amends for really robbing the whole friendship of emotional security. And I made amends to them for what we had done at their apartment while they were out of town. When I made that amends, they finally found out where that used condom had come from. So this was 5 years after. This man and his wife both thought perhaps the other one had cheated for 5 years. 5 years. What if I had not become willing to make that amends? And so they got free. It wasn't about me getting free. So this, you know, people, oh, I don't want to sound judgmental, but, you know, but I'm always tripped out by people that work on 6 and 7 all the time because what they really don't want to do is 8 and 9, right? They come and they camp out. It's like people that come into meetings and they talk about, I turned it over and I took it back. When I hear a person say, I turned it over and I took it back, you've misunderstood the third step. We don't have the power to make that decision happen. If you want to know how to turn over relationships or turn over money to God, you write inventory about it, you fist up it with somebody, you see the character defects that are associated with it, then you go make amends to all the people that were harmed as a result of those character defects. Now you've turned over money and relationships to God. I don't have the power to make the decision happen. All I can do is go through the course of action because it's against the way I've lived my life, and at my core, I do not want to do it. And as that happens, I clear away and I'm able and have the capacity to invoke conscious contact with God. That's what happens in that process. And so if you're a sponsor and you have someone relapse and they come back to you, you have to pick it apart. You have to show them how they were not in the program. How many times have you had somebody come back and say, this stuff doesn't work? And then you say, okay, let's talk about all the unfinished amends you had. Talk to me about step 10. Were you guarding your inner space as you walked around? Were you actually watching for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear? Would you ask and talk to God throughout the course of the day? Did you practice a code of love and tolerance? Did you promptly admit when you were wrong and make amends when you harmed somebody? Did you try to practice cease fighting anything or anyone? Did you try to carry a vision into all your activities? Because if you're not doing that, you're not working the 10th step. And then I want to talk about prayer and meditation. Well, I pray for 5 minutes every morning. That's not it. That's not. No relationship survives on 5 minutes of attention. And then you talk about sponsorship and you talk about practicing the principles in all our affairs. Because this is the easy part. Fortunately for me, a lot of you know me. You know how I live my life. You know my wife. You know my daughter. And so I try to live the way of life described in the big book. And I've watched a lot of people that sounded really good in meetings that did not do that. And so this is important that when somebody you're sponsoring comes back to you after a relapse, you have to prove to them that they were not in the program. Because they suffer from the delusion that they were in the program because they were going to a bunch of meetings and doing some of the step work, like 8.5 steps. It doesn't work like that. not if you're the real alcoholic described in this big book. So it's really important that we really get down to causes and conditions, because you can't just slap somebody and tell them, keep coming back. We're glad you're here, right? What you need to do is find out what they weren't doing and what mistakes they were making that caused their failure. That's what we have to do. Most of the problems that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous will be solved through good sponsorship. One of my heroes says that. It's the absolute truth. Good sponsorship. You know, it's incumbent on me when my sponsees or the men that I sponsor get asked to talk that, hey, when you get up here, you're going to follow this specific instruction in this book, because we're supposed to testify. The third step compels me to bear witness to you what happens when you submit to this way of life. I don't need this book to take somebody through the steps. I think somewhere I may have, I know I have become the big book. Another thing I got from Peter last year, because I'm sitting down right now and taking a man through the steps, and we're going through the book without using the book. We're just going through the 12 steps, and the book's our baseline. And so this is really electric magic. The capacities here are limitless. It's not about just going to meetings. That's not that you're short selling the program if that's why you're here. And if I'm making you uncomfortable, it's not me. God has just used me to make you uncomfortable. God is forcing you to look at something right now. Maybe look at what you're not doing. And asking yourself, have I really ever submitted to the way of life described in the big book? Or do I just pay this shit lip service? Is that all I do? I go to meetings and I talk and I sound good and that's it. This revolutionized my way of living and thinking. That's why I'm so passionate about it. Because I should be up here because I'm up here, right? That's clear. I don't know when people say I shouldn't be alive, but you're alive. Evidently, you should be alive, right? I don't know why my path has unfolded like this, but for my entire life, I looked for fellowship, and I looked for a sense of purpose. When I was out on that parking lot slinging drugs at panic shows, I had a sense of purpose, and I had fellowship, right? So you have to find the same ease and comfort here. The same ease and comfort that you found by taking a few drinks has to be found here. Or suddenly, out of nowhere, the insanity comes. The insanity comes in the state of consciousness we call sobriety. Based on our track record, there's no way in hell we should pick up that drink. That's real sanity. And what happens to us in recovery is we come in here, we get a job. We equate recovery to a job, health, and serenity, right? All of a sudden, we have good recovery. If we get the job back, we get the health back, and we have some serenity. And hell, if you hang out in the meetings long enough, you can fake being serene, right? Fake it till you make it. But those are all very marginal things. What I mean by marginal is they're variable. They change. They're not good indicators. But sanity is a good indicator. And you get sanity if you follow the big book in the 10th step. You're restored to sanity. But for us, there's no telling when you're restored to sanity around that first drink. And that's what it's about here. To be able to lose the job. To be able to ride out an emotional roller coaster. And to have health problems. And to still weather the storm. And so I want to end with I want to share my experience. A few years ago, I went through the steps with a man out in Colorado over Skype. And we get to the third step, and he says, I want you to sit with a consideration for a week. I want you to put everything on the altar. So he goes, when you think of God's will, what comes to mind? And I said, I rattled off a bunch of magnificent things that were God's will. And he goes, well, what if it's God's will for your daughter to die tomorrow? What if it's God's will for you to have a terminal illness and die? What if it's God's will for you to lose your job and not be able to provide for your family? So for 1 week, I want you to sit with all the horrific things that could be the will of God. And then put that on the altar and ask yourself, are you willing to be okay and accept that? And it was one of the most tumultuous, ambivalent exercises I've ever done. And I went to him a week later and said, I'm ready to make this decision. I'm going to put everything on the altar. And this was in 2014. And I'm going to rattle off the events that took place in my life after I put everything on the altar. I slipped on the ice when we had the big snowstorm, and I had a pinched nerve. And it was excruciating. I got a kidney stone right after that. So I had to be pumped full of morphine and put on Percocet or Vicodin, right? And because I've done the work, I've taken the Master's hand, the Master has led me up the mountain, I weathered the storm, right? I was in fit spiritual condition. Shortly after that, I had to deal with identity theft issues. Shortly after that, they tell me I've got to have knee surgery, but they're like, man, you're going to be on crutches for 3 to 5 days. You'll be fine. Well, I get out of surgery, and I find out I'm going to need a knee replacement before I'm 50, and I have no cartilage in my knee, and I'm on crutches for 8 weeks. And then my wife goes out of town, and her dog dies, and I have to put her dog down while she's out of town. And then our house gets broken into. And then my daughter has a seizure, and then we're in the hospital for 2.5 days learning how to handle a child that has seizures. And then I go in and they find, I'm going in to have sinus surgery. They find a bunch of polyps on my sinuses, but while they're in there looking at that, they see my throat has a big polyp on it too. So then I have to have vocal cord surgery to remove a mass from my vocal cord, and I'm silent for a week, which was sort of cool. And then I had to have the sinus surgery. All of that happened in the span of 7 months. I sat in my bathroom one morning and I told God to do things to himself. That's just the relationship I have with God. But I was pissed, I was angry, and I lost my voice. I screamed so loud. And then I dropped to my knees and said, please help me. God was all I had left. The reason I tell that story is because through those events taking place, God stripped me of everything my ego says is me. God gave me a real life lesson in how quickly things can change. And God left me in a position of reverence for this power that keeps me safe and protected every day, because I'm watching people die all the time. I took meetings to the Salvation Army, and I see guys whose first step is so much lower than mine was. And they don't have the willingness that I have, which proves to me it's a gift. I don't know why I received this gift, but I do this like I drank and like I smoked crack. And here's my question for you tonight. Are you doing this like you drank? Are you doing this like you drank? God bless you.